I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. The COVID-19 pandemic has exposed many longstanding problems and inequities in our country, including the fact that Black Americans often live in what are called food deserts in cities where it's difficult to find fresh and affordable vegetables and fruits, putting them at risk for the virus. Food insecurity is also on the rise because of the pandemic-caused economic crisis, affecting an estimated 40% of Black and brown households. On the other hand, there is a vibrant urban farming movement that's been around for decades, not just providing healthy food, but creating community, preserving traditions, supporting health, and connecting people to the land. So today on Radio Times, food and farming and social justice, we have two guests who have joined us by telephone. Kalia Pitts is a writer, culinary artist, co-founder of Our Mother's Kitchens, and that's a culinary and literary project that seeks to create spaces of health and cultural restoration and liberation for Black people. And Kalia Pitts, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Nice to be here. Thank you.
You're welcome. Also with us is Ashley Gripper. She's a health policy research scholar at the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, also a PhD candidate at Harvard's Department of Environmental Health. She works at Sankofa Community Farm in Philadelphia. She's also an active member of Soil Generation, and that's a Black and Brown-led coalition of growers and food justice advocates in Philadelphia. Ashley Gripper, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Hi, Marty. It's good to be here. Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. This is a giant topic. Let me begin with a couple of personal questions. And Ashley, I'm going to begin with you. What is your connection or what is your interest in urban agriculture? I know you work at this Sankofa community farm. What do you get from the farm that you don't get in other parts of your life?
So what I get from the farm is a connection to the land, a spiritual connection, really, to the land and also to my ancestors and the cultural heritage that Black people have with growing food. One of the things that I recently kind of realized is that for me, this connection to land and the relationship with farming started long before I realized that it began. I wrote something recently that I'd love to share, if that's okay.
Sure. In fact, I think that's why you're on the show, because we read what you wrote. But go ahead, Ashley. Don't read the whole thing, because we're going to get to all the parts that you wrote about.
Yeah, so this actually isn't from that. It was a reflection that I've had over the past couple of months. And it says, I sat with my mom, Judy, on the porch in West Philly. She admired my garden and said it reminded her of her late sister, Joan, my great aunt. I shared with my mom, Judy, that spending time at Aunt Joan's house is the earliest and first memory I have of being exposed to gardening. Aunt Joan lived on the 2500 block of Cumberland Street in North Philadelphia. In the summertime especially, I would spend weekends with her, hot and sweaty in the backyard garden, tending to tomatoes and learning about all the other life-giving fruits and veggies that she cultivated. It wasn't until this summer, when the passing of my own father pushed me to start gardening and growing, that I recalled these memories and experiences. Aunt Joan is the person who planted the seeds of food sovereignty in me, and it was through my grief and search of healing that I began to foster food sovereignty as my own reality. And I think that really speaks to what I get from here, why I'm here. My dad passed away in April, and the farm has really been a space where I feel grounded. It's been honestly the only space that I felt grounded and that I felt like I was able to breathe and heal through this traumatic experience.
Well, first of all, I'm very sorry to hear about your father, and I appreciate you reading that. It's really powerful, and it gives us a lot to talk about. Actually, I'm going to just have you hold there and get Kalia in on the conversation. And I was reading some of the things that you have written about your family, your father in particular, and the kitchen and what it was like to be a little girl watching your dad cook. Uh-huh. Take us there.
Well, I do talk about my first memory a lot, which is, you know, being a very young child and watching my dad cook French fries, and I'm like peeking from under the kitchen table. And it's a memory that really defines me and my relation to the work I do with food, but also my relation to my family, my community. You know, I learned to use food, to use cooking as a means of storytelling, and as a means of preserving our culture, like my family culture on an immediate level, but of course our culture as Black people, a part of the diaspora of Black folks in this country, Black folks in Philadelphia. So, you know, the kitchen is my safe space. Cooking is art, it's ritual, it's meditation, it's necessary. And it all began, you know, right in that first moment, just watching my dad.
Watching
you
your
know,
dad make,
yeah, make French fries.
And I bet they tasted good.
They're so good.
Yeah. And you have described kitchens, or perhaps this kitchen that you grew up in, as not just a safe space, but also a sacred place, which, of course, is a really powerful word.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's a, you know, there's a lot of healing that goes into, or cooking and food work, I find to be a very healing space. Not only are you nourishing people physically, like their physical bodies, their cellular cells, but you're also feeding them with, you know, those warm feelings and memories that we have around sharing meals. Sharing meals is something very important to us as people.
Actually, let me go back to you and actually go back to the piece that I thought you were going to reference and that we did post on our on our Facebook page, and frankly was the piece that was the reason we wanted to do this show, because if we're talking about Black farming, it's in many ways it's about what feels like almost everything. But as you referenced, for you in Philadelphia, it took you back to previous generations. You wrote about the fact that you know, there was slavery in your background, that your ancestors were forced to work on farms in the South, on plantations in the South. So it seems that farming also has this really dark history for African Americans. Can you speak to that?
Yeah. So in the piece, I mentioned that my ancestors were enslaved people in Texas, South Carolina, and Georgia. And honestly, that's true of most African Americans in this country. And I think for that reason, we've seen folks, we've seen somewhat of a disconnect from agriculture and our agricultural ways. But the reality is that Black people are a land-based people. We have lived in relationship with the land for centuries and thousands of years. Before we even came, we're forcibly brought to this country. And I think the work that I'm doing is to help folks understand that that history doesn't only have to be painful, that there is so much beauty in how we connect and relate to the land, and that we, in order for us to really heal ourselves and heal our communities, it's going to take us returning to that relationship with the land. And honestly, there's a lot of work around trauma that needs to happen, because what you're describing, Marty, is the trauma we experience, which is not the land's fault, right? The earth didn't cause us to go through that trauma. It was white supremacy and racism and colonialism and imperialism that forced us into those conditions. And I'm really working to help young people in particular to understand that that is not the extent of our history and our relationship with land, that it is so much more expansive and beautiful and symbiotic, really. I think it's important to recognize and position ourselves as not just people who are dominant of the earth, because we shouldn't be. We should be living in community and in relationship with the land. We are, as human beings, a part of this ecosystem, and our relationship with that ecosystem, within that ecosystem, really should be symbiotic and mutually beneficial to all of the living things on this planet.
And as I mentioned, there is so much history here, which we probably won't do justice to. But obviously, you know, after the Civil War, there was, you know, land available, although much of it ended up being sharecropped. Many Black Americans, you know, moved north. They migrated north to find opportunity, something different from what they had in the South. And yet, as you write, in 1920, there were something like 5 million Black-owned farms, 16 million acres that were being farmed by Black farmers.
Yes. And I mean, one of the things I highlighted in that article is that is such a beautiful example of resilience and the resistance of Black people in this country. Because after the Civil War, as we know, Black folks were promised 40 acres and a mule, and then that got thrown out the window. And then as we tried to gain independence and become self-sovereign and self-determined, there were so many obstacles and barriers that came up. And those barriers, like I said, are the result of white supremacy. There were USDA policies, or specifically procedures and practices, that discriminated against Black farmers and made it really hard to get access to land and own the land. And I think when you see those numbers from 1920 of 16 million acres owned and 5.1 million Black farmers, that speaks to the history, the history that our people have of resilience and resistance, and the drive to kind of overcome these oppressive conditions that have sought to tear us down.
Kalia, you want to speak to that? We're kind of toggling back and forth between the land and the kitchen, but from the kitchen perspective, can you speak to that?
Yeah, well, first, you know, before the food even gets to the kitchen, you know, it's coming from the land.
Right.
And while I'm definitely not a farmer, I do consider myself an integral part of that relationship that Black folks have with the land and the food that we are able to get from it. I want to echo what Ashley was saying, that we've been, you know, as Black people, there's a eons-long legacy of being agriculturalists and cooks on small scales and on big scales. Even today, those of us who aren't necessarily farmers, mm-hmm. You know, maybe we're in our little kitchen with a little windowsill garden of, you know, herbs that are barely hanging on like they are in my kitchen. Or, you know, maybe you're able to eat from your backyard garden. But yeah, it's a very, I don't want to say sacred again, but it is a very sacred relationship. And I think the more you introduce folks to having a relationship with their food beyond just going to a store or going to a restaurant and eating, then you encourage people to have more of a stake in their own livelihood and their own lives, because food is such an important part of just basic survival. And then if you're eating some good food, you know, from good land, and you're having a good relationship with that food and that land, then you're focused on thriving. And that's where Black folks really need to be now. We've spent a long time surviving, you know, with just the bare minimum in this country, really everywhere. But, you know, now we can really focus on reclaiming that relationship to the land, reclaiming that relationship to food, and thrive.
Well, you know what? Hold on to that thought, only because we have to take a very short break. That's Kalia Pitts, who joined us along with Ashley Gripper. We are talking about food as social justice, as cultural healing. Do stay with us. Much more after this very short break. We'll be right back. This is Rick.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, talking with Ashley Gripper and Kalia Pitts. We're talking about urban agriculture, how it's had a long and important history, especially for African Americans, how farming in cities is an act of resistance, an act of social expression and cultural healing. And again, just to recap our guest bios, Kalia Pitts is a writer, culinary artist, co-founder of Our Mother's Kitchens. Ashley Gripper is a health policy research scholar at the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. Currently a PhD candidate at Harvard's Department of Environmental Health, works at Sankofa Community Farm in Philadelphia, and she's an active member of Soil Generation. You can join us. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Actually, I was reading about something that activist Fannie Lou Hamer did. This was back in the late 1960s. She bought 40 acres of land. This was in the Mississippi Delta. And she started something called the Freedom Farms Cooperative. Over time, it grew to something like 600 acres. And it was where local sharecroppers and tenant farmers and domestic workers could, I guess, grow things and feel that connection to the land. This is, of course, in the 1960s. Are we seeing something similar to that in Philadelphia and other cities?
I am so glad that you brought up Mrs. Hamer. And I cannot speak with y'all without giving a nod to my mentor, Dr. Monica White, who writes a lot about Mrs. Hamer and the Freedom Farm Cooperative, and really all of the cooperatives that were created across the South as a means of resistance and healing Black communities. I think what we are seeing is a lot of folks in cities kind of understanding that history and understanding that there are issues with capitalism and how we relate to money and how we relate to labor. And what we see as a result is more of these Black-led organizations moving towards solidarity economies, moving towards labor exchange, and thinking about the ways that we can try to remove money and the commodification of labor and resources from the work, the healing work that we're doing in terms of growing food and farming.
Is that what's happening at Sankofa Community Farm?
So Sankofa Community Farm is actually an educational farm. Mm-hmm. So we predominantly work with youth and elders. It's an intergenerational farm. So we're not necessarily engaging in labor exchange in the same ways that we think about those cooperatives. And also we're a nonprofit farm. So a lot of what we do involves bringing youth to the farm to learn about agricultural practices, growing food. It's called Sankofa for a reason. Sankofa means to go back and get it. And how we think about that is that you have to understand your history and where you come from in order to move forward and kind of like and move up. What's the word I'm looking for? And just kind of move into the future in a way that kind of acknowledges that history and allows it to shape, you know, how we continue to move. So a lot of what we do here is around education in that regard. And we have a farmer's market right where the farm is located in Southwest Philly. And that's really an opportunity for us to exchange incredibly low produce that you will not find in any market with community members, with older folks in Southwest Philly. And we exchange stories, right? We exchange histories and knowledge. And I just think about market last week when two of the older women shared, one was from North Carolina and one was from Texas, you know, and we kind of bonded in talking about how most Black folks in Northern and Midwest cities have roots in the South. So while we're not entirely doing cooperative exchange, we are helping our youth to understand that principle and understand what that would look like as they grow up and move into the future.
Well, let me turn back to you, Kalia, because this is what you're doing. Our Mother's Kitchen is a similar kind of thing in that it does involve, obviously, food, but it involves storytelling and community. Can you tell us what you're doing there?
Sure. OMK, Our Mother's Kitchen, started when, you know, my good friend and I, we were actually working at a job with Ashley. We all met together on the job.
Is that right? Okay.
Yeah.
And, small world, yeah.
It is a small world. and we wanted to be able to teach youth in a way that was authentic to Black culture, but still addressing, you know, the importance of proper nutrition and food justice for the Black community. So we began as just a little summer camp for Black girls age 12 to 17. We actually do the camp on Sankofa at the farm. So the girls get to be a part of their entire food system for that weekend. They get to harvest the food that they eat. You know, we're cooking it together. We're telling stories. We're reading the works of Black women and Black men, writers that have come before us that have used food as a means of storytelling and a means of cultural preservation. And then we encourage those girls to write their own stories, tell their own narratives around food and culture and Blackness and Black girlhood. And this would have been our fourth summer doing it. We did have to cancel due to all the things that are happening.
Sure,
now.
I was going to ask you about that.
Yeah, so, but instead we're still remaining engaged with the community. We're having a book jar right now, Books for Black Girls, and accepting any books written by Black female authors that can keep our young folks engaged and remembering that even if we can't be together physically, we're still all doing this work by just finding those stories of culture and telling our own stories and maintaining community. That's a lot of what we do, actually. It's just holding space for each other so that we can rebuild and reconnect and eat good food.
Yeah, I hear you. It's maintaining that closeness and also keeping that safe social distance, which is obviously the tricky thing. Here's a question from Phyllis, and actually, I'm going to toss this to you. She says, when most people hear urban agriculture, they think of indoor facilities that grow trays of hydroponic lettuces. Could your guests explain the difference between that and what happens at Sankofa Community Farm?
Ah, that's a great question, Phyllis. And Marty, I know, you know, I spoke a little bit about this in the article. I think part of the challenge is that urban agriculture has become known as this trendy thing that folks engage in cities. And it's basically like the hip thing to do, right? And I think that largely occurs because a lot of organizations that you see across cities, urban ag organizations specifically, are led by white folks. Those, unfortunately, also tend to be the organizations that get the majority of funding when it comes to urban ag. And I think that, you know, that speaks to a larger conversation around what voices do funders value and what voices are able to speak whatever language it is that these institutions and funders speak. So I think what I'm talking about is very different from hydroponics and indoor growing facilities. Mm-hmm. Because the way I think about urban agriculture is not as just growing food, like growing food. And it's definitely not growing food for the sake of profit. And I think a lot of times when we think of those or when we see those hydroponic operations and those indoor growing facilities, they're growing for the sake of profit. And what I see Black people engaging in cities is growing for the sake of feeding ourselves, feeding our families, feeding our communities, for the sake of connecting with our communities, for the sake of offering social support to our neighbors, for the sake of providing spaces that are safe spaces for us, really, spaces where we don't have to worry about being criminalized or being judged or experiencing police violence or state violence. And I think agriculture for us is so much more than just growing food for the sake of profit, right? I do a little bit of research about like some of the benefits of having your hands in the soil to the microbiome. There's emerging research that talks about that. And I think when I think about urban agriculture, I think about it as this very holistic activity that we engage in, not only for our survival, but like Kalia mentioned, for us as a people to thrive. So there are some clear differences for me, and a part of my battle in the university and institutions has been trying to undo that narrative, the narrative dominance of urban ag being this hip, trendy thing that white folks engage in.
That's Ashley Gripper, who joins us along with Kalia Pitts. And you can join us as well. You can send us an email, as Phyllis did, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can pick up the phone and call us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Kalia, let me go back to you. And as you mentioned the pandemic, and it seems like, you know, almost all conversations eventually are going to lead to the pandemic. And what we have learned and what we know now is that Black and brown communities have been the hardest hit by this pandemic. Some of it, you know, just related to the conditions of people's lives, to poverty, frankly, to access to good food. I wonder if you could speak to that and to speak to this issue about how to use this pandemic as a way to, you know, rethink health and how we can ensure that people have more access to healthy food.
You know, the pandemic, like you said, it's shining a light on an issue that was already there. Black folks were already suffering at, you know, ridiculous rates from just lack of food knowledge, lack of proper food access to real healthy foods. And then we see the plethora of diet-related diseases that, you know, run rampant in the community. So this is not a new thing, but it is something that we can look very closely at right now. And I think what is most important for us as a community is to turn to each other. And, you know, the work that I do, you know, Our Mother's Kitchen, that's what it's about. It's about using food, that basic thing that we all need, something that we know that Black folks in this country are having a difficult relationship with, using that as a means and a vehicle to bring us together as a community. As, you know, we're trying to figure out, Are the kids going back to school? Am I going back to work? Do I have a job? You know, how do I feed my family if the grocery stores get overrun again? We're having all these, like, oh my God moments and all these oh my God thoughts. This is the time to turn towards each other and figure out how can we support each other. A friend of mine is growing food, and I don't have outdoor growing space, so we are now engaging in some kind of barter-esque system where, okay, you can bring me, you know, you have a plethora of greens right now. Bring me the greens and you will not leave here hungry. You know, like I'll make you dinner. I get provided fresh produce. This is a time we could be figuring out those relationships. And the work that is being done at Sankofa, the work that OMK is trying to do, that's what it's about. It's about making sure that we can all benefit from this system. If we're going to really go for, like, true food sovereignty, having true control over our food systems, it has to be done together. And nothing pushes the people together like crisis.
Absolutely. Ashley, let me go back to you. And we all know that in Philadelphia, there is a lot of vacant land. I mean, some of it is, you know, filled with toxins. But nonetheless, there is vacant land there. And I wonder, as a farmer, as an, you know, urban agriculturalist, whether you are then competing with developers over pieces of land, whether, you know, how much farming can we have in Philadelphia? How much new housing?
Yeah. Marty, before I hit on the vacant land question, can I jump really quickly
back to
what you were talking to Kalia about and what Kalia shared in light of turning to each other, I think was beautifully shown and demonstrated to me by my next door neighbors. And they have two very small children under the age of 7. And I've been growing, you know, as I said, you know, as a result of my father passing, I started growing and gardening in my backyard. Anytime I'm out, they're like, Miss Ashley, are you going back to the garden? Can we come with you? So one of the things that really stands out to me about my interactions with them is how excited they are and how much they want to learn. But in particular, there was a time where I was kind of sharing about the importance of growing and gardening. And I talked about, you know, wanting to be able to provide food for myself. And Kaden turned to me and he was like, is it like you need stuff for the wintertime? Because it doesn't grow in the wintertime. And I was like, exactly. And then he was like, and it's like when we had the protests and all the grocery stores were closed, then you don't have to rely on the grocery store. And that was such a beautiful kind of like demonstration of what I feel like Kalia is talking about, of us relying on each other and having also being self-reliant, not being needing to rely on this system that treats food as profit. So just wanted to share that example because it really warms my heart. And now back to the vacant land and vacant lot question. This is a big one, and it's a painful one for me. A lot of the work that we're doing at Soil Generation is around trying to secure land for black and brown farms in this city. And like you said, yes, one of the biggest challenges are the developers that we have to contend with. And the reason that's such a big challenge is because our city council has a lot of power to make decisions about land that is sold, how it's sold, and who it's sold to. So we're really in a battle with trying to get our city council and our city government, our mayor's office, to recognize that people want this land to provide for themselves, that there are people who have been growing in these vacant lots for decades, and for people in power to then be able to sell that land at the drop of a hat because they think it'll this developer will build this beautiful condo and bring money into their district, contributing to gentrification, is really hard for us. And it's a, you know, how do you fight against or fight to support your community and uplift your community and fight to secure land against the city government that has so much power? It's a question that we're grappling with and trying hard to figure out.
Well, we're going to pick up on that after this very short break, and do stay with us. You're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. This is Radio Times here on WHYY.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
In Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen. We're talking about the food justice movement in Philadelphia with Kalia Pitts. She's a writer. She's a culinary artist, co-founder of Our Mother's Kitchens, a culinary and literary project seeking to create spaces of health, cultural restoration, and liberation for Black people. Ashley Grippers is a health policy research scholar at the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, also happens to be a PhD candidate at Harvard's Department of Environmental Health. She works at Sankofa Community Farm, which is in Philadelphia, also an active member of Soil Generation, a Black and Brown-led coalition of growers and food justice advocates in Philadelphia. And you can join us, Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us. That phone number always there for you, 1-888-477-9499. Ashley, is there some kind of compromise between, you know, urban farmers in Philadelphia and developers in Philadelphia, do you think? Or is it just sort of weighted so much on the developer side?
Ooh, that's a big question, Marty.
We're all about big questions today, it seems, right?
I see. So one of the things that I think has come out that has the potential to really support urban farmers in this city is that the mayor's office in 2019 put out a request for proposals for teams to design the urban Philly's first urban agriculture plan. So Soil Generation, in collaboration with a planning studio, was selected to design that plan. And we are our project, the whole plan is overseen by someone at the city. The project manager is Ash Richards. So what we're working hard to do is to develop a plan that really considers the racialized land-based oppression that people in Philadelphia have experienced. And we are doing that by uplifting racial justice, culture, sustainability, environmental justice, in the plan. So we're trying to be strategic about the language that's used. We're holding focus groups and public meetings to engage the community and the public about what they want to see in this plan. An example, we at our first public meeting in December 3rd, we had over 300 people in attendance.
Wow.
Just to weigh in about, just to learn about what we're doing and how they can support the work and weigh in. And this is, of course, at no shock to the organizers, but I'm sure it was a shock to city council and city government, who had previously said that urban agriculture is not a constituency in Philadelphia. There are a lot of folks engaged in this work. And I think in terms of, you know, is there room for both developers and urban farming?
There's a lot of space in Philadelphia, as we know, right?
There is. There are thousands and thousands of vacant lots, lots that were previously not wanted by developers because they were in quote unquote undesirable neighborhoods, right? These are the same lots that Black and Brown folks have been growing on for decades. So I think whatever relationship comes out between developers and city council and city government and urban ag folks, it needs to prioritize people in this city. It needs to prioritize the people who have been in this city for generations. It needs to prioritize feeding the community. Like you mentioned the pandemic earlier, we see that food is really an issue. Food, people don't have access to food, or the food that they do have access to is incredibly unhealthy. And one way to really step into kind of like filling that need is to help folks to understand the power and agency in growing your own food. And I think that honestly, I think that the developers and the city government need to take a back seat and listen to what communities want.
Let me go back to you, Kelly, and then we've got some folks that want to join our conversation. I know one of the things that's part of the work that you do is something called confidence in culture as a kind of public health model. Can you explain what that is, how that works?
Sure. Confidence in culture was a theoretical health model that I developed during my time getting my master's in public health at Temple. And the model was really focused around a food and nutrition intervention that I was doing with a group called Sunday Suppers, which is a nonprofit that encourages healthy food behaviors through eating together as a family. What that model shows is that by increasing a community's cultural pride, like knowledge of their cultural past, and knowledge of the needs that are within their culture, by focusing on feeding that cultural pride, you increase feelings of self-efficacy. So I was trying to get families to adopt a healthier, more culturally appropriate diet. And this is a group of mixed families of mixed ethnic backgrounds. And each week we went through a different region of the world to look at people's different ethnic backgrounds, whether you were from the Mediterranean or from the Caribbean, from the African continent, wherever. And we examined the food ways of each of, you know, those regions and groups of people. And you could see as families, and, you know, this is kids as young as 5 up to grandma who's like 89, as families are learning together about the history of their people as it relates to food, they started to feel more prideful in themselves. Like, oh, I know where I'm coming from now. You know, I know why we do the things that we do and we eat the foods that we eat. And it also helps to stop demonizing ethnic food ways, right? Because now you learn there's a reason that we eat certain ways and that we have certain kitchen practices. The more that folks felt like they could see themselves in the nutritional knowledge, the more they were able to adapt those healthier behaviors. They felt more confident in their ability to move forward. And I think, you know, what Ashley was speaking to with gentrification as it applies to, like, land ownership and what we do with land, that same thing happens when, you know, we think about nutrition. And nutrition and food is such a, you know, it's a world that has been taken over by whiteness. And sometimes, especially speaking as a Black person, it's hard to see, you know, how you as a people are represented in that. And if you can't see yourself in that knowledge, then why even take it on? Why adopt a healthier diet if it's just something that white folks do?
Well, and just a quick follow-up, if you don't mind, because I do want to get a caller in, and we got some comments as well. Is it that, you know, white people, broadly speaking, because they write the cookbooks? I mean, you know, they own the restaurants? Is that what you're talking about?
Well, yeah. I think, I mean, our nutritional knowledge comes, it only speaks to one kind of eating. You know, if you were to look at the food, my plate, you know, or even any of the food pyramids we've had over the past few decades, where do Black food waste fit into that? Where does quote-unquote soul food fit into that? That's a demonized diet until it's co-opted by whiteness. And then, it's, you know, so, well, look at these healthy collard greens that we're cooking up in this five-star restaurant. And that's not the full story.
I hear you. Let me get to, it looks like Gwen from Berlin, Pennsylvania, to join us on Radio Times. And Gwen, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, this is Gwen from Berlin, I applaud these efforts. I had a thought with regard to the competition or the tension between the developers and the vacant lots that are either currently being used or could be being used. And I know this would be like a baby step and not addressing the whole very layered issue of gentrification, but is there any opportunity similar to how we require developers to do something in the beautification with murals and other artwork when they do a project? Might there be a thought of maybe tying in an urban farm type situation and efforts towards that, maybe even like sharing the you know, instead of murals and sculptures, there's urban farms as another option, or maybe pausing the beautification? Is that something that would be an inroad?
That's a great question, Gwen. I'm going to toss that to you, Ashley. What do you think?
Thanks, Gwen. That was a great question. And I think for folks who might not be familiar, what you're speaking to is incentive zoning or mandatory inclusionary zoning. So a lot of times developers have to engage in like certain practices or make agreements in order to get their buildings approved. And I think that's a potential step, right? And the only people who would have the authority to kind of make that decision, really, because of the way Philly's zoning is set up, is the Zoning Commission, City Council, folks in that realm. I think, like you said, it's a step, and a drop in the bucket, and hopefully we can push for more than that. But at a minimum, I think that is something that should be considered.
Here's a comment from Hendrix. My mother grew up on her parents' farm in South Carolina in the early 20th century. She nurtured a connection to the land my great-grandfather purchased in 1871 with money he had saved as a sharecropper and former enslaved person. She grew lots of flowers and vegetables in our backyard, which was the size of a postage stamp in Washington, D.C. And Hendrix says, I continue that tradition in my own yard in Princeton today. Really speaking to what both of you are talking about. I'll toss this to you, Kalia, just, you know, how food takes us back to previous generations, to a different time and place. I think for all of us, it's just a different story depending on who you are and where you came from.
Yeah, I think many of us have those kind of stories of, you know, my grand whoever, my great grand whoever, you know, having some a backyard plot, or if, you know, lucky enough to have a whole farm. And there's a generation or two that kind of got missed in that as we moved more towards this quote unquote modern era. but we are returning to that. So not only are we, you know, practicing Sankofa, go back and fetch it, go back and get it, in order to complete our story as it relates to like just our health and food, but we are also completing our family stories, you know, making that cultural connection across the generations. Yes, I'm growing food just like my grandmother did, just like her mother did, just like her father did, just like her auntie did. And you continue in that legacy that we've had for generations.
Actually, we were talking about, you know, farming, black farming, and the history of it. And I read that today, I think the farming, 1% of farms are owned or are run by black farmers. Is that your reading as well?
Yeah, I think one of the numbers I quoted was in 2017, the USDA Agricultural Census reported about 45,000 black farmers, mm-hmm. Which today it's about the same amount in terms of percentages. And honestly, I don't want to say it's heartbreaking, but it's really sad. And I think it speaks to, like I said earlier, a legacy of trauma and also a culture around whiteness and white supremacy that has intentionally disconnected black folks from the land and from their relationships to the land. But the thing that gives me hope is how I see young people today really engaging with this work and really seeing the value, the benefit, and the deep history behind the relationship with land outside of slavery, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that piece is the piece that I'm trying to hold on to, as opposed to the sheer numbers that we see, because those numbers are actually growing. Another thing I think is important to note is that what the USDA considers a farmer is not necessarily the same thing that we, like what we consider a farmer.
I was wondering about that. Yeah, no, go ahead.
And a lot of times, according to the USDA and according to folks who work in kind of like government or whatever, a farmer is the person who owns the land, right? Not necessarily somebody who's working to steward and care for the land. And I think that speaks to larger kind of issues in our system around capitalism and ownership. And I know I personally believe that we can't own the land. The land is sovereign on her own. If we are working the land, we're stewarding the land, we're caring for the land as the land is caring for us, then in my opinion, we are 100% farmers and growers, despite what the official definitions are in the census.
Kalia, final question to you. Is there not that you have to give it away, but is there a family recipe that has been handed down through the generations in your family?
Oh, goodness. I don't know if there's been a family recipe.
Maybe a way of cooking.
I just come from a cooking family. I can't think of a particular recipe that we've been handing down for years and years and years. But I know that the kitchen is our home space in my family. You know, my father cooks, his father cooks, my mother cooks, my siblings cook. I will say that a popular drink at either my household or my parents' household is a ginger lemonade type of drink. Mm. We're very into brewing ginger teas, and everybody has their preferred recipe and their preferred method.
Ginger tea. That sounds just about perfect mm-hmm. for a day like today. Kalia Pitts, exactly. Thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you. Great
You're
being
welcome.
Here.
Nice to have you with us. And again, co-founder of Our Mother's Kitchens, Ashley Gripper, thank you for joining us as well.
Marty, it's been a pleasure. Thank you for having us.
You're welcome. And she's a health policy research scholar at the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. She works at Sankofa Community Farm and is an active member of Soil Generation. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about the program. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us.